Yeah. Great. My name is David Turner, and I work for the Free Software Foundation. My job includes enforcing the GNU GPL and working on version 3 of the GPL. I'm going to talk to you today about trusted computing and some of the free software licensing implications around that. And if you have questions, please feel free to interrupt me at any time. I actually prefer being asked questions to just talking, so go ahead. There will also be a chance for questions at the end. So first, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what trusted computing can and can't do, and then I'm going to tell you about why you should care. So okay, what does it mean for something to be trusted? It's an old joke among people who oppose trusted computing that something is trusted if it can break your security policy, which is the U.S. Department of Defense's definition of trust. But the trusted computing group, that's Intel, Microsoft, HP, bunch of other companies, has a different definition. Their definition is, if it always behaves in the expected manner for the intended purpose, what does that really mean? It means that someone looking at a machine which is trusted under the trusted computing definition will know what it is going to do when you give it certain input. So they came up with this because they had these problems, and they're hard problems. How do you deal with the case where your bank's web server has been taken over by bad guys, and then you're about to send them all your financial information? How do you know? Or how about this? How do you give someone data, right? Your name, your date of birth, your location, all this data which is personal, private information about you, and then control how they're going to use it? There's a bunch of really interesting financial cases. One of them is this concept called a reusable proof of work. So here's the theory. You want to stop spam or some other thing. You want to create a computational currency. The idea being that when you send a mail, you pay using this currency. And the neat thing about it is that it's reusable so that whoever gets the currency can then pass it on again. So you can do this by, hash is the traditional solution. You take a cryptographic hash and you partially break it. You get, say, 20 bits of it, which represents a certain amount of computational effort. Then, once you've done this, you go to the server. The server says, here's a hash, you partially break it. You go back to the server gives you a token, which you can pass on. Other people can verify by going to the server. Now, to make it reusable, what you do is you go to the server, and you say, I'm going to trade in this thing, which I've used, and you're going to give me a new one. Now, the old one won't validate anymore, but the new one still will. The question is, how do you trust that the server isn't just going to give out to these tokens to anyone? How do you trust that they actually represent a certain amount of computational effort? Well, one way you can do it is trusted computing. Yet another area is, let's say you've got an online game, right, Quake or something. You want to make sure that the person playing Quake is actually a person, right? It's not some kind of mad Quake-playing robot. The advantages here are that robots can do things like see through walls. The game has to send you data in advance of when you actually see things. Otherwise, it would be too slow, network latency, that sort of thing. So you want to make sure that people are using a Quake client that doesn't cheat in that way. And finally, Trojans. If someone takes over your machine, you want to know that it has happened. So, solution, trusted computing. You prove that computers will run the way you expect them to run by knowing exactly what software they're running. Not knowing things about it, not some sort of proof technique based on mathematical models or anything, but knowing the exact binary and having assurances from the people who created that binary or having done tests upon that binary so that you know exactly what it's going to do. The technology that enables this is called trusted computing. And your primary thing is a chip inside your computer, inside new IBM laptops that are newer than this one, for instance, called a trusted platform module. So what it has is a cryptographic key pair for public key encryption. You've got a private key, which is secret even from you. In theory, no one at all knows this private key. And a public key, which is, of course, public. You've got an engine that can do cryptography, not general-purpose cryptography. This isn't something that's designed to accelerate SSL or anything like that. It does a certain set of cryptographic operations. And it's also got some registers, platform configuration registers. These record the state of the software on your system. So you have these basic functions, which I'm going to tell you about in a minute. And these are the functions that the chip can perform. So to start off with, your computer boots in a certain way. It's a step-by-step process. So step one is that the bootloader gets the trusted platform module measures. This is trusted computing speak for takes a hash of the bootloader, puts that into PCR 0. Then the bootloader loads the second stage bootloader, takes a hash of it, puts it in PCR 1, etc. until your entire operating system is booted. Now, you might say, well, there's a lot of software you might be running, so you're going to need a lot of PCRs. But the spec actually only calls for 16 PCRs, the first 8 of which are reserved for certain system functions. So what you can do is you can update a PCR. In fact, the only way to add data in to a PCR is this update function. And what it does is it takes the old value, it takes a cryptographic hash of the new value, concatenates them together, hashes the result, and sticks that back in the register. So it's a destructive process in that you're not sure what you're going to get out of it. Well, you're sure what you're going to get out of it, but you can't set it to some arbitrary value. And it also preserves this history. If someone else knows the input data, the set of input data, they can do all those steps, the combination and hashing, and check your result. Check that if you say, first I loaded bootloader A, and then that loaded bootloader B, etc., and they have the access to that data, they can do exactly the same checking. So the state of your system, from the perspective of trusted computing, is the set of all the software you have loaded. That's everything from your bootloader, your operating system. If you're running a debugger, they can go in and modify the memory of another running process, which, as you can imagine, would be pretty useful. All of that can be known by examining the PCRs. So this is pretty cool, because it can prevent Trojans. So first I have to tell you a little bit about one of the other operations that your trusted platform module can perform. It's called sealing. What it does is it encrypts a piece of data, usually a key, and includes with the encrypted key a set of platform configuration registers. And it will only decrypt that data when the PCRs are in the same state as they were when the data was encrypted. That means that if someone modifies your operating system to, say, send off your passwords to Microsoft, the FBI, whatever it is, then they will not be able to read your keys. Because when the application loads, there will be a different application. And a trusted platform module, which is a piece of hardware, so of course they can't modify it without going into your computer. And it's designed to be hard to modify. It's, you know, under a chunk of epoxy, that sort of thing. So if they modify your platform configuration register, if you trust a platform module, you're still in trouble. But without doing that, they cannot alter the applications that are on your system, because if they do, you will not be able to access your data. So, okay, that's a pretty minor thing, right? It's a minor security threat that we're dealing with in a straightforward way. But the other feature is a little bit more interesting. So we have remote attestation. Now remember that the trusted platform module has a private key, which means that it can do cryptographic signing. Now, your trusted platform module has a certificate, which is someone has signed up your key, the manufacturer of your TPM. And if someone trusts the manufacturer of their TPM, they know that you would not have the certificate if your key were not associated with a genuine TPM, which will perform exactly as expected. So what you can do with this is that some server wants to know what software you're running. So they send you a random number. You sign that random number together with your PCRs and send it back to them. Now, there's nothing here that says that you have to do this. If you don't want someone to know what software you're running, then you can say, I'm sorry, I refuse to answer you. I refuse to tell you what software you're running. And then they can say, I'm sorry, but I refuse to deal with you. I refuse to send you whatever data it is you've requested. It's a pretty interesting technology. And it actually has a bunch of good uses, too. You'll notice I'm telling you all these good things. I'm going to tell you a bunch of bad things later. So one use for it is you can tell what a server is going to do. So if your bank's system has been corrupted such that when you say transfer $100 to Fred, it does something entirely different than transferring $100 to Fred, you can tell that because you can tell what software the bank is running. Likewise, medical privacy. This is really cool, actually. I know in Europe you have all sorts of rules and regulations about who can send data to what, right? But in the United States, it's a pretty much a total free-for-all. We're just starting to get rules in this area. And even with rules, things could still get screwed up. There could be bugs in the software, there could be malicious doctors, all sorts of things. So imagine this. Before your doctor's computer will be able to send the data to some other doctor, it will check that that other doctor's computer is in fact owned by the doctor, that there's some genuine relationship with you, all of these things, which can be checked remotely by ensuring that the software that the doctors are running does these things. Pretty neat. And of course, distributed computing applications, pretty straightforward. You know that no one is going to, if you're running a key cracking server, send you a bunch of fake data. Oh yes, of course I've checked these keys, because you know that they're running your genuine software. Okay, so now I've told you about the good things, right? Why should you give up on all this? Reject it? Well, the reason is, it's really dangerous. And before I go into why it's dangerous, I'm going to tell you some of the technical details about copying. This is stuff that you probably think is pretty straightforward, but maybe not. So all of the data that matters in a computer is a series of bits, right? Computers don't do qualia. They don't know what the experience of seeing the color red is, right? That's something that you obviously can't represent in bits. You can say, well, this many nanometers, but that doesn't tell you what it's like to see red. But all the data that we actually care about, software, music, movies, laws, newspaper articles, all that is just a sequence of bits. Now, computers, general purpose computers, are machines for processing data. That's what they do. If you can read some data, then you can copy that data. And if you can copy it, then you can modify it. That is, you can make a modified version. You can't necessarily change it in place. If something's burned onto a CD, of course, you're going to have a hard time. Everything that a computer knows about the world is data. What that means is that it's really easy to lie to a computer about what's going on in the rest of the world. They trust everything you tell them, and all their input is data. And of course, data can be modified. So if that's true, then how do we have restrictions on what you can and can't copy from a technical perspective? From a legal perspective, it's pretty straightforward because laws deal with things that are not data. Well, digital rights management, as it's called, we prefer something like digital restrictions management, has historically never, ever, ever worked. And the reason is that anything on a general purpose computer that is trying to prevent you from making a copy is a piece of software. But software is just data, and you can change the data. So anything that checks to see if you've done this, that, and the other thing before you make a copy, you can just hack around that. And that's what people have always done. Now, when you put a piece of hardware in the way, it's a lot harder. Hardware isn't data. You can't modify your hardware. And specifically, you can't get to that one piece of secret information, that one private key that is on your TPM. So here's roughly how you do digital rights management. You've got this trusted boot sequence, and then you've got some application which manages access to media. For example, it will play songs, but it won't let you copy them to your friends. So your operating system takes this the measure of this media manager, it takes a hash of it, sticks it in a PCR, does remote attestation to the media server, which is going to send it the media, right? And the media manager then gets that media back and immediately seals it, locks it to its particular configuration. Now you'll notice that horizontal bar there. Step six, in order to play media, right? You don't have to be online to do this, right? Because any modified media manager will not be able to unseal the media in the first place. So now you've built this digital rights management system in a way that's basically unhackable. Now, obviously, you can hack your hardware. Right? You can hack your hardware. But the thing about hacking your hardware is that every time you want to hack your hardware, you have to start afresh. You can't copy someone else's hack. I mean, you can copy the technique, right? But once you get the process down to a science, the cost of, for instance, a mod chip is some fixed hardware cost. It's not zero the way the cost of software is. And as hardware copy prevention technologies become more prominent, the cost of breaking them is going to become higher. For example, consider the cost of mod chips for game consoles. I haven't done the numbers recently, but when I checked a year ago, the more advanced the generation of the console, the more expensive the mod chip. And in some cases, they're getting up to $100 to $150. So, compatibility. How do I make my own media manager that can download media from the server and do what I want with it? Or even not do what I want with it, even if it does have some restrictions on it? Well, there's a real problem here. You can't. Because your media manager isn't known to the person who is sending you media. And that's true in applications in general. Let's say you've got a word processor, right? You want to make a word processor that is compatible with Microsoft Word.
Why?
Well, because some of your friends still use Microsoft Word, the deluded fools. And you're trying to get documents from them and build something that will replace Microsoft Word for them. Now, you can say, well, throw out all your old data. You made the mistake of doing it in Microsoft Word. Okay, but that's not a solution that's likely to win you many customers. Bad idea. Better idea would be if you could say, well, sure, we can read your old documents, no problem. But if those documents are sealed to Microsoft Word, and if Microsoft Word does not have an export functionality, then you are absolutely screwed. You cannot write compatible software. So this isn't just bad if you're a free software manufacturer. Let's say you work for a proprietary software company and you're making, let's say, a web browser that, you know, 0.1% of the population uses. You're going to have a problem if certain documents that you might want to view over the web are locked in this way so that only the mainstream browser can do it. So even if you're not interested in free software, although if so, what are you doing at this conference? Even if you're not interested in free software, it should still frighten you that such a technology exists. So what do all these things depend on, right? Well, they depend on some essential network service. Why? Okay, you want to use Microsoft Word, right? In a way that's going to let you get your documents out of it, right? So here's what you do. You build a virtual trusted platform module that uses some hacked key from somewhere that Microsoft hasn't known about yet. And you run everything on top of that, and you're good. But that doesn't work when there's a network service in the way, because you've got because then they can do an online check to make sure of what you're really running. So digital rights management in a trusted computing universe depends on networks. So do most of the other things that you care about, all of these data privacy things. All of this depends on the remote attestation functionality. Now, what's interesting here is that this isn't the first time we've seen networks used to reduce copying. You cannot copy World of Warcraft. Well, okay, so you can copy the World of Warcraft game engine and CDs and such, but what you won't have access to is the vast universe of new content plus the large group of players. So, from the perspective of Blizzard, they don't really care. I mean, sure, they're going to tell you that you can't, but they don't care if you copy their client, because you still have to be paying them $10 a month, or whatever the cost is, to get access to the game world. But this is an extension of that to areas even where networks aren't strictly necessary, like the distribution of media. So the digital rights management case, we at FSF had been using the code word New York Times for, because we think that, you know, in terms of an organization, it's one that might try to do this. They might want to say, well, we don't want you to access our old articles where we're supporting the war in Iraq, because we look really stupid now. So we're going to prevent you from copying that, and in effect, destroy history. The other case we're thinking of, we've been calling TiVo. No, not that TiVo itself is necessarily doing this, but it happens to be one that we thought of first. Now, listings, you know, what TV shows on when, all of these come from TiVo's server, and you're paying TiVo a certain amount a month to get access to this data. Now, TiVo has an interest in you not hacking their machine, because they presently have a very sweet deal with the media companies, where the media companies don't sue them, and in fact, are partial owners of the TiVo Corporation. And in return, TiVo doesn't have the features that you actually wanted to have. They keep trying to remove things like commercial skip, And they have removed things which let you copy shows off of your TiVo and onto someplace like that you would actually want it to be, like BitTorrent. So the TiVo system, at least last time I checked, was based on free software. It's a GNU Linux system. Now, if they could determine the state of your TiVo before they send you these listings, then they could cut off access if they find that you have changed your software. So it could become impossible, well, not actually impossible, but difficult to upgrade your software, even though the software is free software. So this prevents you sort of a paradox here. On the one hand, you've got all these great security features, some of which are, you know, genuinely supportive of human rights, a lot of these privacy type features. Another really good example of a privacy feature. Does everyone know about Tor, the onion router? Raise your hand if you've heard of it. Okay, a few of you have heard of it. I'll tell you a little bit about it. What it does is it prevents people from knowing who you are when you are sending data on the internet. And the way it does that is you encrypt your message in multiple layers of encryption and send it to a set of servers. Each server unwraps one layer of encryption to find out where to send it next. Finally, when you've unwrapped the last layer of encryption, it goes out to the target. This means that people can't track who you are when, for instance, you're downloading things from BitTorrent, or when you're sending out documents describing what the Chinese government is doing to you. All these things. Now, of course, if someone takes over a large percentage of the servers, then they can trace the route of your packet. Big problem. But what if you could determine what software the servers were running? That way, even if someone took physical control of a server, they wouldn't be able to change the software without being detected. So that remote attestation feature is really useful for building a secure trusted, building a secure onion routing network. Combined with BitTorrent, that's the end of the media industry, basically. Assuming you can get the content in there in the first place, which you basically can. So you've got all these great capabilities of trusted computing, but yet it's going to restrict your freedom. So if we get rid of trusted computing entirely, we destroy it in some way, either by destroying it in the market or by legislating against it or any of a number of other ways, we reduce our choices but increase our freedom. So this is actually kind of an odd paradox, but it comes up in a few other cases. Let's say you are a woman, and let's say that you live in Afghanistan. Now, Hamid Karzai said, "Men in Afghanistan, it is important that you support the right for women to vote. After all," he continued, "you can always control whom they vote for." What? Okay. So, one thing that you can do to prevent people from stopping others from voting is make voting compulsory. That way, if an Afghani man says to his wife, "You can't vote because I'm afraid you're going to vote for a more liberal candidate," then the woman can say, "But I'll go to jail. You don't want me to go to jail, right?" So a requirement, compulsory voting, gives people more freedom, the freedom to vote. Kind of interesting. Another example is an anti-boycott law, a law that says you cannot participate in a boycott of a certain country. I think the U.S. used to have this with respect to Israel. A lot of the Arab countries wanted to boycott Israel, of course, and wouldn't do business with companies that did business in Israel. So there was a law or a proposed law, I can't remember which, that said, you can't cooperate in these boycotts. If you do, then you'll suffer the consequences in the U.S. Now, companies actually like this because, of course, they want to sell to the broadest market possible. And they want to be able to go back to the Arab countries and say, well, okay, it's either do business with you or do business in the U.S., and at the present, the U.S. is still bigger. So, reduce freedom, the freedom to not deal with Israel, increase freedom, these laws going in the Arab countries going away or being not enforced in these cases. Well, so, okay, trusted computing is really bad, right? We've got the potential for history, the newspaper archives, all these things to be totally locked up. We've got the potential for consumer devices, the things that we use every day, to be totally controlled by major corporations. We have the destruction of competition in the software industry. All these things are really horrible. Shouldn't someone do something about it? Well, okay. Notice in the background we've switched, it says provisional. Everything I'm going to tell you from now on out is entirely experimental. Nothing is set in stone. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what might possibly, potentially, conceivably happen in version 3 of the GPL. However, none of this is 100% decided. It is all speculative. So bear with me and bear with the background. So step one is, couldn't we sue the manufacturers of trusted computing systems under antitrust regulations? Well, maybe not, right? The people who make the chips aren't controlling how they're used. And the people who are controlling how they're used say, well, you know, we're just, it's a decision we're making. It's not necessarily a decision that everyone else is making. There doesn't need to be any collusion. As long as everyone has the chips, or at least enough people have the chips, 90%, whatever it is, you can, on an individual basis, without colluding with any other company, restrict access. No one has to collude with Microsoft in order to make Windows the only platform on which you can view media, or maybe Windows and Macintosh, your two choices, Coke and Pepsi, rather than the whole universe of choices we have now. No one has to collude. It's just an individual decision. So maybe that'll work, and maybe it won't work. I have very little confidence in the United States regulators, but I understand that Europe is slightly better. Well, okay, what about this? We can't do anything about the New York Times case, but maybe we can do something about the TiVo case. Here's one idea that I had. This is a fantastically bad idea, but it's an idea. What if we say that the free software contains functionality which smashes the PCRs, that is, it sends updates with random values such that they can no longer be used for anything ever thereafter during that boot. You want to smash the system. I understand that you want to smash the system. And I'm going to explain to you why you shouldn't smash the system. Hang on just a second here. So this would mean that free software can't be used with trusted computing applications at all. Now, free software is really great, like amazingly great. And the world's momentum is moving towards free software. But we are not quite there yet. We do not have the type of market power that it would take for PCR smashing to be a viable option. Right now, we are trying to convert our friends, some of whom are unfortunately Windows users. We are trying to convert them over to free software. And if they say, well, we'd love to use your free software operating system, but then we can't view all these movies that we downloaded from iTunes too. Then we've cut them off from ever having a migration path away from the world's proprietary software. So this is something that's very unlikely to happen in, for instance, the next version of the GPL. And we don't recommend that other free software licenses try it either. Well, okay, so the real problem in the TiVo case is you can't upgrade. So what if we had a provision that required you to offer equivalent access to upgrade? I mean, the problem isn't really that you can't upgrade. Because if I give you a CD, right? You can't change the data that is on the CD itself. You can copy that data and make changes there, but you can't change the data that's on the CD because it's burned onto a write once medium. So equivalent access means that if you, a distributor of software, can upgrade the software in a certain way, then you have to offer equivalent access to do that. Now that may mean that, let's say the software is signed and there's something that checks signatures included with the software, then you'll have to include your signing keys. Or if the software is encrypted in some way, you might need to include your encryption keys. This doesn't necessarily mean that general privacy in software is going to go away. You can still do some sort of encryption which doesn't block people from modifying it. For example, don't use signing. But there's still a problem here. Let's say TiVo says, well, okay, our software is not going to block you from altering the software on the device. But our network service says that if you've modified the software, you're not going to get access. Now, we can't control what network services people offer. But what if we instead offered replacement network services for all of these essential network services? Now, one way you could do this is take over the server. So back in 1991, when version 2 of the GPL was created, software distribution happened by giving away copies. Okay, that makes sense. Users of software generally had access to copies of that software. But this is 2005, almost 2006. Nowadays, most of the software that we use every day, we don't have access to. Google, for instance, you don't have access to the source code of Google. You have no idea how Google works. You don't even have access to the binaries. So what can we do about this? Well, let's say we've got some software that's based on free software that's running one of these network services. Well, we've got a hack, which is instantiated in the Athero license. That's a prototype for this particular feature, our version 3 of the GPL. And again, provisional warning, this is all experimental, subject to change, etc. What this provision says is that if you modify the software, then if the software has a feature which gives you a link to the source code, then you must make sure that that link still works and that that link still points to the current source code. So why such a convoluted thing? Why not just say, well, if you're running the software on a server, then you have to give someone access to the source code, right? That seems much simpler. And the answer is copyright law. So we can totally say that if we were writing a contract, a bilateral agreement, back and forth between two people. We don't want to write a contract. And the reason we don't want to write a contract is that contract law differs in every jurisdiction of every country all over the world. There's all these rules and regulations which change from place to place. Copyright law, on the other hand, is mostly standardized. The Berne Convention, 1886 and updated every 10 years or so, is the standard for copyright. And it says that the things that are exclusive rights of a copyright holder are distribution, that is, giving someone a copy, copying, same thing, making a copy even for yourself, and modification, plus some other things about public performance, that sort of thing. So modification is an exclusive right of the copyright holder. So we can say, we're copyright holders of software. We're going to give you a license. That is, we're going to give you permissions without you having to agree to anything. And if you do something that goes outside those permissions, then what we're going to do is we're going to sue you for copyright infringement. Another nice thing about this is that copyright infringement, at least in the United States and I think in a lot of other countries, has something called statutory damages. That is, I don't have to say this software is worth X amount and you did Y copies, so X times Y is, and that's how much you owe me. Instead, what I say is the law says you owe me this much per copy, and that's the way it is. That way, that makes trials a lot quicker. And it also makes a very nice threat. I can go to someone who has violated my copyrights, which this is part of my enforcement job at the FSF, and say, do you really want to be in trouble for X thousand dollars, and I can't remember what X is, per copy? No. What you want to do is deal with us. Be nice. So remember I mentioned public performance as one of these exclusive rights of the copyright holder? So, what does it mean to publicly perform a piece of software? Well, I just read a report from the European Union which thinks that downloading a piece of software is public, or offering a piece of software for download is public performance. Now, this seems to me to be straightforwardly not true. Microsoft, for instance, doesn't think it's true. When you look at their EULA for PowerPoint for the European Union, it doesn't mention anything about the public performance of PowerPoint documents, even though it allows you to distribute them. So, okay, maybe not. But maybe what it means is allowing use of the application over the network. And if it happens that that's what it means, then maybe what the GPL will say is, if you publicly perform this software, then you have to make sure the people to whom you publicly perform it get the source code. So that's another strategy that we might try to keep free software free, even in a trusted computing world. Now, before we move on and take questions from the audience, I'd just like to say why I'm talking to you about this now rather than in 2003, which is when the major bulk of the trusted computing work was done. And the answer is that in 2003, trusted computing looked like it was going to take over and be very dangerous and all these things. As 2004 came, we noticed that no one was using trusted computing. Sure, you can buy a machine with trusted computing in it. If you buy an IBM laptop newer than this one, for instance, you will have a chip in it. But until you have enough adoption, then you're not going to actually have a problem on the media and software distribution end, or on the compatibility end. But 2005, we saw a really interesting announcement back in June, I believe it was, which was that Apple would be switching to Orange, well, to Intel. And what does that mean? It means that they must be tremendously worried about people getting copies of the software from their friends and running it on the cheapest Taiwanese-made white box PC hardware that they can find. Well, how are they going to prevent that? It turns out that according to reports from beta testers of the new Intel-based Apple machines, they do in fact have trusted computing inside those machines. So when a fairly mainstream manufacturer like Apple, and I know that they're only 1.7% of the computer market or whatever it is, but of the market for Apples, they're a whole lot. And they're certainly a trendsetter in a lot of ways. When a major manufacturer adopts trusted computing, you have a real risk here. And so that's why I'm warning you about this risk. And I'm urging you to fight in any way you can the adoption of trusted computing, whether that's by talking to your local legislators or watching what computers you buy and not buying from manufacturers which use trusted computing, whatever it is. Fight. Questions?
What do you think is the role played by the factor of selling a product without trusted computing as a feature? For instance, in the new generation of game consoles, we have the PSP and the new Nintendo, and then there is a new game console that has been announced that is called GP2X. And it's completely free. They provide an SDK which is based on GNU Linux, and you can produce your games and then release them free.
I
already placed an order. And they provide you with this SDK, and they say we are back to the good old Amiga times for the gamers, like that you can produce your own game and just distribute it. So this is the factor of not having trusted computing, and then it's a feature, because eventually games are going to proliferate more on those platforms and eventually be more fun. So what do you think is the role played by this factor?
I'll tell you, I actually think that's great. If you can offer something that's a compelling alternative to trusted computing, and if you can explain to people why they care about this, then you're going to do really well in the marketplace and destroy your competitors. No one wants a product with less features. Everyone wants a product with more features. And if you offer that system, then you're going to clean up in the marketplace and you're going to help the freedom of all of your users. And you're going to help the freedom even of people who are not your users, because competition from you is going to change the incentives on other distributors of software and hardware. So yeah, I think absolutely that's a great idea. And
so
we have
a hole for competition here in the world capitalist market.
Well, we do have a capitalist a competition rule, but there's a few limits on this. One of the limits is that if you're building a game console, on one hand, you don't want to pay Sega, for instance, or Sony or whoever it is, $100,000 for an SDK. On the other hand, you don't want other people, your users, to copy your games. So maybe you'll say, well, it's worth $100,000 to be on this closed platform. So that's a risk. The other risk is that we do not live in a free market society. We live in a society which has a free market as long as it suits the major corporations. And if they can legislate their competitors out of existence by mandating trusted computing, as they've attempted to do in the United States a zillion times with this whole alphabet soup of laws, you know, CBDTPA, SSSCA, induce all of these, DMCA, DMCA2, super DMCAs, whatever they are.
This mess you out really.
Yeah, if they can legislate all these their competitors out of existence, well, then they win. So it's something that is going to require market action, but also action outside of the market.
I have a question, mainly to answer also to Jeremy. There is the problem that the biggest manufacturer of cheap computing is China, and China is maybe willing to trade the access to the G8, G9, with adoption of legislation for copyright. So if they get in debt, then you don't get hardware.
Well, China actually already has all sorts of laws against copying. The laws are not enforced because China is a big enough market that people other countries simply can't push it around. I mean, the U.S. can't push China around specifically, even though it produces, a large plurality of the world's content, because China is the only thing that is keeping the dollar afloat. China keeps buying dollars. They're the only things that keeps the government from having to declare bankruptcy and all that would entail. So it's going to be pretty hard for China to put pressure on. Now, also, China has some conflicting goals here, because on one hand, they really like the totalitarian aspects of trusted computing. Oh, I can tell what software you are running remotely. That's kind of neat. On the other hand, the prospect of a super Tor, an onion router that is provably secure, has to be frightening to them. And they have to be afraid of that level of access to information. And Tor is not quite there yet technologically. You can use it, but one out of every 10 or so connections will time out, and the rest will be very, very slow. But Roger, the gentleman who wrote it, is working very hard on it. He's gotten money from the Electronic Frontiers Foundation to work on it. And they have to be afraid that that's going to totally break down their firewall, that everyone will be using this super core. Other questions?
This little chip eventually receives a key and then decrypts the flow of data that comes from any kind of provider. Is there any limitation why this cannot be emulated on the software?
Software emulation.
Yeah.
So you can, in the general case, emulate a trusted computing chip with a fake private key and such.
Okay.
The only problem is that you do not know the private key of a real chip, which means
everyone is different.
Every chip is different. Yeah.
This message is very expensive.
Well, you could produce your own chip, too. The problem is that you have to get a certificate from a manufacturer that is trusted by whoever you're trying to authenticate to.
Well, but having it emulated in software would allow anybody who knows to try all possible keys and...
you're not going to be able to try all of the possible keys, first of all, because... the authentication is remote, which means that they can cut you off after, say, three tries.
Okay,
and second, the key space is too large.
So if you're not connected to the network, you cannot process, let's say, these. Is this also for media you buy or just for stuff you get from the network?
Well, once you download it from the network, right, then it is encrypted on your hard drive using some standard symmetric algorithm. But it's going to be something like 256-bit AES. Which you just don't have the computing power to crack. And even if you do in one case, it's going to be a different key for every piece of media. And if they want to be really paranoid, for every chunk of every piece of media.
But then it means that in order to play that thing, you have to be
connected. No. To play it, you don't have to be connected because it's sealed, right? What happens is that the chip will refuse to decrypt the key that the media is encrypted with unless your computer is in the same configuration. And you can't emulate that chip because you don't have the private key which is inside the chip. So yeah, the security issues have been thought out pretty well. And I, as an amateur cryptographer of no note, at least think it's secure. And certainly, you don't see serious cryptographers saying, well, this just isn't going to work. It unfortunately is going to work.
I'm not a user of modern stuff, of modern media, let's say, so I wouldn't care about it at all. But I understand most first.
Well, you probably read the newspaper online.
No.
No? Or?
No, my mother sends me newspaper clippings from
the Where's your live journal?
Well, that's okay. One day all of your friends will have live journals and they'll wonder, why can't you log on? Why can't you tell what's going on in the life of me and my cat? I have all these beautiful cat pictures to show you. When will you get a live journal? But you can't because of trusted computing. Not that I think the live journal would like you to do this. But. Other questions?
You mentioned that, as an example, that New York Times could choose not to give access to older articles.
Well, they could. What they could do here is they could say, we're going to give you access only if you are using a browser which implements R features. And these features are that you can't copy and paste, for instance. Right? So that way, I mean, of course, anything that's already posted, you can get to them. But things that are new, that they don't want, you know, that they want you not to be able to archive for your own reference, then you might have a problem. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but they can't,
it's not retroactive.
Yeah, so they can't kind of revoke, if you have copied something and they've given you, say, downloaded a PDF of some text, and then 2 years later they wanted not to, you to be able, they can't kind of revoke the license to read it.
Well, actually they could, if the media viewer application supported that functionality. It, that would require an online media viewer, a media viewer that only will show you an article if they're actually on the net and can authenticate to the Times server, which they might want to do. But for the basic functionality, which allows offline reading, which is what you're probably going to see first at least, then they can't do that. Right. I guess they could check the computer's clock, and they'd have to have a secure clock inside the chip. So trusted computing that and the trusted computing group are only one of the groups working on this. And another is Microsoft on their own. They had what used to be called Palladium and is now called Next Generation Secure Computing Base. And what that has is a bunch of other security features. For example, Secure I.O. It will authenticate your monitor and make sure that your monitor is really, for instance, a monitor and not something connected to another computer which is reading data. So that means that you can't, there's no longer this analog hole where once data is output somewhere, you can re-record it. So there's a bunch of areas like that. And actually, Secure I.O. has some beneficial features, too. You could use it, for instance, on your keyboard to make sure no one's put a bug in between your keyboard and your computer. Kind of neat. A secure clock, I'm not sure if it's actually part of any of the proposals, but it could conceivably be part of a future proposal. And in that case, they could automatically expire access after a certain time. I'm not actually convinced that a secure clock is going to end up being that secure, because eventually the battery is just going to run down. And you're going to need to be able to copy things. Well, maybe it'll be secure, I don't know. So it could happen, you're right. Other questions?
I don't know really, but what my question exactly is, but when you have big companies that have to trust each other because they are doing this trusted computing thing, would there be a possibility for some kind of self-regulation where big companies don't trust each other anymore, and that is actually the time bomb ticking beneath the whole trusted computing thing? As you said, Microsoft is already doing its own little kind of thingy, and if they...
Yeah, I'm not actually that worried about standard fragmentation, or I guess not that hopeful for standard fragmentation. I think that next generation secure computing base can be built on top of TCPA and can merge with it. As far as I know, only one feature in it, which is not in the most recent revision of the trusted, I guess TCPA is the old name, TCG is the new name, the Trusted Computing Group specification. So. I think that we're more likely to see convergence than competition here, unfortunately. It's an interesting point that you bring up, the idea that technological trust can replace business trust. Certainly there are cases where I would like to do business with companies, but don't have business trust in them. And one of the ways that I have business trust in a company is that I know where it's located, and I can go to the nearest courthouse and sue them, right? That's, I'm not a lawyer, but both of my parents are lawyers, and so I have a fair idea of how the court system works. And that's really nuts. If someone, screws around with me, as, for instance, my last landlord did, I could say, okay, well, I'm going to sue you now. And then they say, okay, I guess I'll return your security deposit. Now, if the company I'm trying to deal with is in Hungary, I don't have business trust because, Hungary, I don't know what the Hungarian laws are. And I don't speak Hungarian even a little bit. If the thing I'm dealing with is something for which technological trust is appropriate, for example, if I am giving them my email address, and I want to ensure that they will not send on that email address to the spam kings of the world, then I could do this using technological trust. I don't think, however, that it's likely to be used that widely in these situations because of power. So if you are a buyer in a transaction, typical online transaction, you are spending 10, 25, 30, 100 bucks on something, right? You are just a fraction of the business of the company that you're dealing with. What that means is that you don't have any power. If you say, I'm going to walk out, right? Unless you can convince a whole bunch of your friends to walk out with you, they're going to say, that's nice, we still have 9 million other customers who are perfectly happy to deal with us. Now, companies are not likely to install this software for various sorts of data privacy if they do not have to. And they're not going to have to unless a good portion of their customers demands that they do. So the major problem with trusted computing is that it makes worse this power imbalance, because now not only don't you have power, but they can enforce regulations on you that they're not willing to have enforced on themselves. Does that, I guess, answer your sort of question?
Yeah, sort of.
We have a chat question. I don't know very much about it, but they are listening to the stream. And it's what
would happen here? Go ahead.
Yeah, I can put. I will put you now. It's what will happen to free software with the new copyright law in Finland?
I'll tell you. I haven't actually read the new Finnish copyright law. Do you have some details, you person across the stream, about what it says?
Yeah. Well, he just gave me this link. Well, everybody has it. Finnish Parliament approved today a controversial new copyright legislation based on European Union's copyright directive. The legislation sparked enormous opposition. The parties currently in coalition government decided to approve the legislation without further modification. Well, I don't know very much about
it. Okay, so when I was reading about it, and admittedly I was reading about it on perhaps the least reliable of sources, that is Slashdot. The major problem with it was that it made it harder to copy for personal use things like movies, software, music, that sort of thing. It didn't have anything to do with free software. I do not think a country that is a signatory to the Berne Convention can actually screw up the major free software licenses, because the limitations on how far copyright can go and how not far it can go are straightforward and not things that we have to worry about. For example, let's say copyright law becomes really strong and thinking about software is something that's an exclusive right of the copyright holder. Well, the GPL says that things that are not covered by this license are permitted. So the GPL doesn't put any restrictions on when you can think about the software. So you can go ahead and think about it, even if that someone's copyright law says that thinking is an exclusive right. Now, I guess someone, if you were like Microsoft, could try and push through a law that says that free software is banned. But that's not actually likely to happen. First, the free software community does more than Microsoft does. What it does, in terms of the amount of work, the amount of person hours of effort it puts in a year. We've actually done more historically, and we're doing more now. And companies of every size are using and depending on free software for their core business needs. So while the software industry is big, the list of companies that use software is even bigger, and the list of companies even that use free software is even bigger. So I don't think that such a law is likely to pass in the short term, a law that says something like the GPL is forbidden, whatever that would mean.
I have another question. But how much you think is the chance for a non-profit initiative, more or less legitimate, to gain trust into this trust?
Well, the problem here is that trust isn't something that's a single number. I don't have 17 floating over my head representing the aggregated amount of trust that the community has in me. Instead, each individual person who is making an individual trust decision gets to decide on where they put their trust. And what that means is that if you have something that works for the user, well, that doesn't match the trusted computing definition of trust, which is that it works the way they want it to, for the reasons they want it to, and the purposes they want it to. So you can't produce your own TPM, which is a privacy respected, freedom respecting TPM, because no one will send you data for keys that are signed with them. So I think that if you're going to form a nonprofit group that deals with this, then the nonprofit group ought to be aimed at destroying trusted computing entirely, at persuading major vendors not to adopt it, and at persuading users not to buy things that have it.
More the feeling that this kind of attempt is a kind of blocking entropy of knowledge. It's like trying to block the natural entropy of information that keeps the information interesting. So practically it could be, in a perfect world, that this is a tree that burns dead somehow. And would be, I mean, as Jeremy was suggesting before, leave the space to a lot of interesting thing that is not mainstream, that you will have access because it's not part of the trusted computing thing. Like all the content that is no more or less copyright, that is usually much more interesting than recent content that has copyright. And all the content that is not on the major five list, for example, music, or in independent filmmaking, things like that.
Yeah, I think that some of the smaller producers of media are starting to discover that people who copy their music aren't their enemies, but are their friends, because they're building mindshare for their product. This is something that a lot of the bigger companies haven't yet discovered. Surprisingly, even the Japanese ones, who ought to know better because they have this great tradition of fan-created works based around copyrighted major company-owned works. So, is it likely that we're going to have a free culture movement which grows in size, which produces better art, and which simply wins in the marketplace? Well, maybe. It's certainly something that I hope for. But I think that for the foreseeable future, content produced by major companies is going to continue to be valuable in a lot of ways. So I think that's a long-term solution, and it's a valuable solution. No question about it. It's something that I think that we ought to try really hard to do, to support free culture. But I think it's much more long-term than short-term. And of course, the danger is that the means of production will be restricted to only the major companies, which trusted computing does not itself do, but there's certainly some network effects.
Pixel is on a good groove, therefore we are on the right track.
I came to Pixel because I think it really is an important conference in this respect, because you're doing all this free software video stuff, and you're getting the means of production into the hands of the workers.
There's a proper Creative Commons talking this time. Last time was kind of introducing Creative Commons stuff, it was kind of boring.
Well, the thing about Creative Commons that you have to watch out for is that it doesn't actually stand for anything. What one thing do all of the Creative Commons licenses provide for you? Asks Mako, who's a Debian hacker. And the answer is nothing. There is no right that you absolutely have, no matter what Creative Commons license you're using. So when you say Creative Commons, it's this wide spectrum of things, some of which are quite laudable, the Creative Commons attribution only or attribution share alike license. But others are not so useful. They're, they say, well, we're just going to put more restrictions on you. So it's a nice idea, but it's something that really would benefit from having a little bit more politics to it. Other questions?
I don't really get the case in which you are allowed to see data on your screen, but you're not able to store it, because you can always take a picture of it and redigitalize it or something.
Yeah, you can take a picture of your screen, it's true. It's going to be difficult, and it requires expensive hardware. You need something that's reasonably a reasonably good video camera that can sync up with your screen, because, of course, if you're using a monitor that's a CRT, at least, there's a refresh rate. And in fact, there's always a refresh rate. CRTs are just worse. And you're going to need to synchronize that. And even so, you're going to have some loss in quality. Now, companies that make movies and music have tried in a bunch of times to block what they're calling the analog pull, that is, the thing that lets you record sound as it is coming out of your speaker, record video as it is appearing on your screen. However, none of their proposals have been particularly successful, and the only way they're going to be successful is if they legislate their adoption. So when those laws come before your parliament, you should oppose them and support groups that oppose them. But yet, it's not perfect, but it's one step along that spectrum.
But there is also digital watermarking.
Oh, yeah. So just a word about watermarking. What watermarking can do, in theory, is determine the origin of some set of content. Now, this is pretty straightforward if you can't modify the content. But the thing about a watermark is that it has to be both robust, that is, still be there even when you make transformations to the data, and invisible, that is, it has to not change the appearance of the data. So far, no one has built a watermarking technology that has not been cracked, because it turns out that it's really hard to do that. Necessarily, people can take various combinations of sources. I got the same data from Fred and from John and from Jane, and put them together, right? Thus canceling out the watermarks. Now, some of the watermarks try to take this into account, but you can tell where the changes are, right? You've got the same content multiple ways. You can tell what's been changed. So I think it's not a technology that's likely to make a big difference.
No, but I was thinking about just watermarking the copyright flag and having in hardware not to tape that. You know what I mean?
Oh, I see. The broadcast flag, for instance.
Yeah, but watermark.
Oh, a watermark-based broadcast flag. Yeah, in that case, your theory is that you're not going to be able to get a copy without the flag. Right. That's going to require redesigning every piece of hardware in existence. And it's not actually likely to happen, because the kind of hardware that you're going to need to redesign is an analog to digital converter. Now, I was never an electronics student, but I am told that this is a first-year electronics student project to build one of these things. So as long as we have people with soldering irons and parts in the right place, we're going to be able to build things that get around that. Maybe it'll be a little bit difficult, but I think that's something that's not a viable strategy technically, and it's not a viable strategy legislatively, because the amount of product re-engineering that has to be done, I mean, when I look around this room and I count the number of products that will have to be changed, how many of you have camera phones? Right, you're going to have to add an extra little chip to those. That video camera right there. All of these things will have to be altered to make sure that they can't record what other people don't want them to record. It's not likely. It's not likely legislatively, and it's not likely technically. So you should still fight it, because it'll be a hassle if it passes, but that's going to be the easy fight. Further questions?
Maybe you could go back a little bit. I'm a bit slow in head, but come back to the comment on Creative Commons and what you were saying, that it was a matter of politics. Could you kind of go a bit deeper into that?
Yeah, I'll be glad to go a little bit deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Creative Commons is trying to start some kind of movement,
mm-hmm.
but their movement doesn't have any ideals. There's no principle that you can say, when I see a work under Creative Commons, I know, well, what do you know? You don't know anything about it. It might say that you can give a copy to your friends, or it might not. It might say that you can modify it, or it might not. It might say you can sell it, or it might not. So without this kind of principle, how can we say, we're going to build a new world of media, we're going to have some place where we can stand, where we can do, well, wait, what can we do? We just don't know. So that's why I think that while some of the Creative Commons licenses are a good thing, Creative Commons as a movement is somewhat incoherent.
So, am I right if I read your criticism as they are too pragmatic in a way and less idealistic? Or
well, so the evaluation of an action as practical depends on what it is that you want to practice. If you're, it's not clear to me what Creative Commons wants to practice. It's practical if its goal is to become very, very popular, as it has. But if the goal is something to do with freedom of information, then a lot of these licenses, the Developing World license, the sampling license, aren't actually that good for freedom.
Actually, talking to Creative Commons people and realizing basically their goal is to give tools to the people, to artists, to choose the licenses of their own works. And there are no clear tools now. They want to give tools to the artists. It's not political. It's helping the artists have easier way to tell what others can do with their work.
Okay.
But then we can better distinguish among the artists which one they are really
doing. Want to read. That's their goal.
Okay.
I think it's an interesting goal to be able to give these tools to the artists, but I'm not sure it's necessarily the best idea, because if you don't give them guidance as to how the tools should be used, then how are they going to pick their right answers? It's also weird that they say that, because clearly they're opposed to certain tools. For example, they're opposed to digital rights management, which is laudable. All of their licenses, or at least all the ones I've read, say that you can't use digital rights management on this work in any way, shape, or form. So I think that they almost have an agenda. They just can't get through that final push to get somewhere with it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Any further questions? Just have a few more minutes left here, I think. Great, thanks. Thank you.